Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. And I'm joined today by Chloe Benjamin, who is out with a brand new novel, The Immortalists. It is available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Putnam. Chloe comes to us. She's a Wisconsin person now, and but nonetheless, Chloe comes to us on the heels of her last best-selling book, which was just fantastic. But Chloe, The Immortalists here, the premise of this book, people knowing the day they're going to die. And can you kind of take it from there? Because I hate to give away anything in the plot line, so can you sort of summarize it for me?
So The Immortalists takes place starting in 1969. Four siblings are bored on a hot summer's day, and they hear about the arrival of a mysterious woman who claims to be able to tell anyone the date they will die. So the siblings go and they pool their allowance and they visit this woman and receive their prophecies. And then the novel follows each one of the four over the course of their lives and looks at the way that fate and chance and expectations shape our futures.
How do you think a fortune teller, a mystic like this, would be perceived if these characters had been adults? Because I know at age 42, if somebody told me they knew the day I was going to die, I wouldn't believe them. Do you think it only works if
yeah,
it's kids?
Exactly. Oh, I think you're so right. I think it has a lot to do with the innocence and the craving for knowledge and the belief in magic that happens when we're young. And so one of the things I was exploring is how these prophecies really plant inside the kids almost like a germ in a way that it might not have if they were older and they had shed this belief in the impossible.
You've got the four kids, and Simon ends up in San Francisco as a ballet dancer, and it's during the basically the genesis of the AIDS crisis in America. And really, your book, more than a novel, takes us through basically the last 50 years or so of Americana. Is that how it started out for you, or did that sort of just develop into that way?
Well, I think that's it's a great question, and maybe a little bit of both. I always knew that I wanted this book to follow the siblings into their adulthood, and so that meant I was going to be covering a lot of time. I've loved books myself that follow characters over many years. I just find them really moving and fascinating, and there's a kind of delight and surprise of seeing how somebody's life twists and turns. So I don't think I knew when I started the specific time periods for every sibling. I did always know that Simon would be a dancer, that he was gay, and that he moved to San Francisco during this particular time. But for the others, it was the slower process of figuring out, you know, okay, where would their lives take them? And also, what were some complementary time periods and professions that would speak to the rest of the book so that they were all in conversation with each other?
I've literally never read a novel that featured a character who was a magician before, and yet here you have Clara as she's a magician. She's doing these crazy tricks and things like that. So when you put together that, had you had any magic background, or did you have to research that a ton just to see how magicians work?
Research it a ton just to see how magicians work. I always say I went down the rabbit hole of the magic community, and as you might imagine, it's a very deep hole and full of secrets. So, you know, some of the information was a little hard to figure out because, as Clara says, magicians as a species are pretty tight-lipped. But that was such a fun section to research, and I came away with just a total respect for and fascination with the world of magic.
I would think that it's easier to do research on magicians now than it would have been, say, 20 years ago, because now you can get on YouTube and basically find out how every trick worked. So, and that sort of takes the magic out of it anymore, right?
It does a little bit, but I think there's still something amazing about how people can, you know, use their hands, use their bodies, misdirection. I mean, even things like the psychological element of flashing a card at a viewer for the tiniest split second longer than another card and how that will make it stick in their mind. You know, there's a real risk to that. It might not work, and the fact that it does is kind of amazing. So I think even when you know the secrets to certain tricks, they're still kind of incredible.
Well, a lot of it's in the performance, but, you know, getting back to the book, there's all kinds of overarching themes in the book, you know, the talks about life on Earth versus life after death, things like that. And when you delved into the philosophical, or the characters did, as you did that, were you basically looking at religious and spiritual subtext or science and
the whole clash between religion and science? I guess it's an age-old question, right?
Yeah, I was. I looked at both, and for me, the novel is about how we cope with the uncertainty of human life. And so I see religion and science as actually less polarized than you might think, or even less polarized than I thought before writing the book. I think there's a lot of overlap in terms of the way that we cope with mystery. Of course, religion holds a place for mystery and kind of celebrates it, and science seeks to find out. But it was interesting to find out that maybe there are more parallels between those belief systems than I knew.
Well, the four siblings here, they come from Jewish background, and I was raised in a Christian background, but I've known people who grew up in the Jewish faith, and it seems like there's a break-off point between how Jewish folks live their lives versus Christian folks, because Christian folks are always thinking about the netherworld, the heaven, and all that stuff. I don't think that was as prevalent with people that were raised the Jewish faith, or am I just misreading that?
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I grew up, I have kind of an interesting religious background because I was half Jewish and half Christian. My parents are divorced, and so I practiced different religions at each house. And so but it was really in the research for this book that it hit home for me. Because, of course, when you're a kid, you don't really get all the nuances, nor do you really focus on reading, you know, the Torah. But I realized that Judaism places very little emphasis on what happens after death, whereas Christianity, as you say, places a lot of emphasis. And so I thought it was really interesting to place these siblings against a religious background that didn't give them the sort of relief and possibility of a heaven. When they know their dates of death and they don't have that mental comfort, how do they live their life differently?
So do you think that would have posed a big problem for the characters had at least maybe one of them converted to Christianity and just decided to go live in a monastery or something because knowing that something better is coming?
Now you're making me wish I had explored that a little bit more. That would be interesting. There's so many directions to go with a book like this, and I found myself like, when you're thinking about death and you're thinking about predictions, there's so much you can do. But yeah, I think that would have been really fascinating if somebody had been drawn to a form of Christianity that really focuses on the hereafter.
We're talking with Chloe Benjamin, author of The Immortalists. It's a brand new book. It's available now in hardcover and in electronic format from Putnam. You can get it in any bookstore or get it on Amazon. And I'd tell you the price on it, but nobody pays full price for a book anyway, so it's completely ridiculous to even mention that. So, but Chloe, as we get back into this, the biology, the child that becomes a biologist, she's into the scientific background of prolonging life. And as you did that, I don't come from a science background, so I learned a lot from reading this about how these different organisms work, particularly the jellyfish. Can you kind of explain how that came to be as your focus for that character?
Yeah, so I always knew that I wanted Varya to be a scientist. Varya is the eldest child, and she's the one who is the most fixated on scientific explanations. And she's a longevity researcher, and what that means is that she's focused on prolonging human life, and not just lifespan, but what scientists call health span, so the healthy years of one's life, because, of course, nobody wants to be a, you know, decrepit 150-year-old for a long time. So she works with primates, and she's running a study that looks at caloric restriction, so whether eating less can make you live longer. But in the course of that research, I learned about a ton of really fascinating organisms, and kind of going back to what we were saying before about the magic that's inherent in everyday life, the jellyfish that you mentioned is one called Turritopsis dorni. If anybody's interested, I highly recommend a New York Times article that came out maybe 10 years ago about a scientist in Japan who's working on this creature. But essentially, when it reaches the brink of death, it has the ability to revert back to the first stage of life, to the polyp stage. And scientists still don't know how it does this, kind of a Benjamin Button type process, and it's really amazing.
And, you know, that's the, one of the phrases that you used in the book here was, I thought was just absolutely beautiful, the siren song of family. And we all know families who there's people that don't talk to each other and all of that. And even though you don't have communication, there's still that influence of where you were raised and where you came from. Do you think that's true of all families after just lived with this Gold family for so long and writing this book, that no matter how far you get or how long you're separated, you still always come back to your roots?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that there will always be an effect. And I think some people remain estranged and some people might come back to that nuclear family, but it's impossible for it not to affect you really profoundly. Childhood is such a petri dish of a time, and we can't escape the impact of those familial relationships. So one of the things I take as a compliment is when people say that after reading the book, they decided they had to call up a sibling. Because I think, you know, okay, then I maybe did my job in some way.
You got your MFA at the University of Wisconsin, and I've talked to other authors who've gone through the MFA program there. How did you find the experience as a writer? Was it like a military boot camp style, or was it a peaceful experience for you?
No, it was a peaceful experience, I would say. But challenging in all the good ways. Yeah, an MFA is a graduate degree in creative writing, and I went right out of college, which a lot of people say, don't do, go get life experience, but I felt like, well, why can't life experience and an MFA happen at the same time? And I loved it. I never pictured myself moving to the Midwest. I'm from San Francisco, and now I call myself a born-again Midwesterner because I really love it here, and my husband and I have settled. But the MFA, essentially, you're workshopping, you're writing, which means that the other people in your cohort are reading it every week and commenting on it. And then also I was teaching undergrads, and so that was really scary because I was 21 myself when I started the program, and I was like, nobody should have me as their college instructor. Like, this is really too bad for them. But I loved it, and I wound up really growing as a person and as a writer through that experience.
Do you lose any sense of ego that you may have about your writing as your peers are reviewing and making comments? And then is it hard to do that to other people as well?
It is hard, but I think it's good preparation for the loss of ego that happens when you start getting real reviews out in the world for your work. It's never easy to cope with critical feedback about your work, especially when it's artistic work. I know I feel really vulnerable right now. It's scary to have this going out into the world and to feel like, even though it's fiction, it's still very much coming from me. But that's part of being an artist, and that's part of the incredible gift of having an audience. So I try to remember that balance and tap into the gratitude.
Well, after The Anatomy of Dreams came out, I mean, you were unknown in the literary world at that point. That came out, went like gangbusters. Now people are waiting for The Immortalists, and it's coming out with a huge rollout. What's that like to have that bubble burst where you're not writing inside a vacuum anymore, and people are going to be saying, what do you got next? What do you got next?
It's really surreal. I actually feel like with Anatomy, you know, even though that book got some wonderful press and we were lucky enough to get a regional award, it really was nothing like this experience. This one is, I think, going bigger in a different way, at least, you know, knock on wood so far. And so I feel that sense of kind of anxiety about the next project and how to write under expectations much more now than I did when writing The Immortalist. I really feel like with The Immortalist, I just went back into my cave. I didn't feel any pressure. I didn't feel like people were kind of like, oh, what's Carl Benjamin going to do now? So, you know, assuming that this book continues to reach a lot of people, I think that's something I'll grapple with this time around.
Well, you've hit home run with this one. It's The Immortalist. It's a novel by Chloe Benjamin, available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Putnam. You can get it on Amazon. You can download it in your electronic formats. Go check it out. Chloe, just a fantastic novel here to start the year. Thanks for putting it out, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for spending time with this book. I so appreciate it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Whoa.